was a little bit... Usually I come down here, I don't have a clue what I'm going to talk about. Just I think ahead, some days ahead, and what am I going to talk about? Usually I don't know. Usually I don't think I have anything to say. But today I had too many things that I want to talk about. I had like three different options. Didn't know how to decide between the options, but I think I've decided. And of course, there's always a risk when you decide because it might be the wrong one. It might not be the one that speaks to you. So we'll, you know, it's not. You know, so we'll take the risk. On Friday, we had a Dharma practice day here, and the theme was the Dharma in brief. And there's a number of places in the discourses of the Buddha where the Buddha talks about the Dharma, kind of a nutshell. This is what my teachings are. And so we have some technical excitement. Maybe the machine doesn't like my choice. Should we wait or should we?
It's recording.
Is everybody here okay? The speaker's working okay? Okay, so we'll just go ahead. So I wanted to talk about a couple of these Dharma in brief statements, and especially one of them that since our meeting on Friday I've become more intrigued with, since we looked at it and studied a little bit, and maybe you'll help me understand it better, or part of it, the story that's part of it. There's a very short, there's a paragraph where that's sometimes presented then as kind of the Dharma in brief, or kind of the sudden school to enlightenment, the quick school. If you get this one thing, just do it, you know, you'll get instant enlightenment. And the story involves a man who pretty much did that. So it's very nice. And this little teaching is often given in Vipassana retreats and Vipassana contexts. And sometimes I think of it as the liturgy of the Vipassana world, because part of the liturgy, the kind of things that we repeat a lot and read a lot. So what I'll do first is read the passage, and then I'll tell you the story that's around the passage. And it's a story that intrigues me more than the passage at this point. I'll give you just a very brief part of the story first. There was a man named Bahia. I'll give you the story. Excuse me. There was a man named Bahia of the bark cloth. Bahia of the bark cloth. And he was a spiritual practitioner who had a lot of followers. And he just, probably just wore cloth made of bark. So maybe he was some kind of ascetic. And he had a lot of followers, very successful as a spiritual teacher. And he... one day he asked himself a question. And the question was... Now, of those who are enlightened or have entered the path to enlightenment, am I one of them? That's what he was wondering. And there was a little deva, little god, who used to be a relative of his, who overheard him asking that question to himself. And he came over and said, and gave him an answer and said, you know, you are not enlightened, and you're not even on the path to enlightenment. So, you know, probably that's kind of got his attention. After all, he was a successful spiritual teacher. And so he asked the god, the devata, what, you know, where he could find someone who was enlightened or on the path to enlightenment. And the deva said, you'll find such a person in the northern country. The Buddha, who is fully enlightened, is living there now, in Savatthi. He is truly enlightened, and he teaches the Dharma that can lead to enlightenment. So Bahia gets quite excited, feels a sense of urgency, and makes his way to Savatthi directly. And it's about, according to the story, it's about 700 miles distance. And no, it's 700 miles. And he goes, depends how you translate the Pali, but one translation is he did it in 24 hours. He was so, you know, a sense of urgency. Another way of translating the Pali would be that he went there only stopping a night at one place at a time, meaning he didn't linger any place. He just went. It took him 7-8 days or however long it takes to walk 700 miles. But he would just sleep for the night and then keep going. He wouldn't rest. Anyway, so he was pretty determined, and he went right there to the Buddha. And he arrived where the Buddha was camped, and the monks were there. And he asked the monks, "Where's the Buddha? I need to ask him a question." And they say, "Oh, he just left for his alms round to collect his food for the day." And he said, "Okay, I'll go after him." So he goes after him, and he finds the Buddha. And he sees the Buddha as someone who is calm and calming, his senses at peace, his mind at peace, tranquil and poised in the ultimate sense, accomplished, trained, restrained, the great sage, the great one. And so he approached him, and he threw himself down at his feet. So here's a spiritual teacher who left everything behind, and with maybe some humility or humbleness or something, desperation, threw himself down at the feet of the Buddha and said to him, "Teach me the Dharma. Teach me the Dharma that will be for my long-term welfare and happiness." So you can kind of sense this is really important for this person, Bahia. The Buddha, in response, says, "This is not the right time for asking me this kind of question. I am on my alms round, collecting food for the day." Maybe it's a reasonable thing to say. You know, he only eats one meal a day, so doesn't want to be interrupted. And so Bahia says again, "No, please tell me the Dharma. He's really urgent. He wants it now." And the Buddha says again, "You know, this is not the time." And then Bahia says again, "Please, you know, tell me the Dharma." And the Buddha, when you ask a Buddha three times, the Buddha basically has to go do it. So then this is what the Buddha said. And this next paragraph, next passage is this liturgy of the Vipassana movement is used a lot. "Well then, Bahia, you should train yourself like this. In reference to what is seen, let there only be the seen. In reference to what is heard, let there only be the heard. In reference to what is sensed, let there only be the sensed. In reference to in the cognized, that there only be the cognized. This is how you should train yourself. For when there will be only the seen in the seen, the heard in the heard, the sensed in the sensed, the cognized in the cognized, then, Bahia, there is no you in connection with that. When there is no you in connection with that, there is no you there. And when there is no you there, you are neither here nor there nor in between. Just this is the end of suffering." The end of suffering is synonymous with enlightenment or liberation in Buddhism. So it's kind of a little bit maybe difficult to understand what's being said here. But one of the reasons it's so popular in Vipassana is the opening paragraph, opening section says, "In the seen, let there just be the seen. In the heard, just the heard. In the sensed, just the sensed." And this points to something that we call bare attention, and a very important aspect of Vipassana practice, and that is learning to tease apart what's actually happening in the moment from the concepts and interpretations and stories that we add on top of it. So if I'm sitting here and I hear a loud car drive by, It's just sound. I can just let it be a sound. Now just be the sound. That's one option. The other option is this, that was a great, good, low roar of a car. I bet that was one of those cars they talked about in the front page of the Chronicle on Friday or Saturday. One of those cars that cost $300,000. I bet it was one of those. It'd be great to have one of those cars, you know. And they go from 0 to 60 in 5.5 seconds. And, you know, and one of them was a stretch kind of thing. And there's a picture of the guy in the Chronicle, you know, stretched out with his legs. I'm kind of long, right, so it's kind of hard for me in the back seats of cars. And this is been far out there. And it'd be great to have one of those cars. But then, you know, actually, you know, I'm a Dharma teacher. And, you know, it'd be kind of embarrassing. And actually, it's kind of, you know, arrogant to have those kinds of cars. And it's a waste of the environment and waste of money. I mean, $300,000, you could spend do a lot of wonderful good for that. And that's not an example of leaving the herd in the herd. That is getting involved, getting caught up in it. And that getting caught up and involved can be very seemingly innocent. It could be as simple as saying, oh, that car was too loud. Maybe it was too loud. Maybe it was really loud. But just I get involved in it. Or it could be quite complex. And off I go and I come back tomorrow. Because the story goes on and on. And so to simply sit and hear something and leave it alone as just the herd, where the mental activity of engaging in it in any kind of way is put to rest. The mind is in such peace, such rest, that it doesn't engage in the activity. Part of the importance of this for Vipassana students is so we can see very clearly what we're adding this extra to the experience. So we can take some responsibility for the extra that we're adding. Because it turns out for many of us it's very hard to tease those apart. And we're often confused between, we often confuse or intermingle, entangle our interpretation of an event with the event itself. And so often we suffer because of that, or we cause other people to suffer because of that. But to learn to tease them apart and begin understanding how the mind operates, how the mind engages, thinks, goes into trains of thought around things, is a very important step towards learning to become freer. If you can see the separation, tease them apart, see the gap between it. So in Vipassana, we train ourselves in part to rest and bear attention. So when there's a sensation in the body, we just leave it as a sensation in the body. When there's a pain in the knee, one of the ways of complicating that pain is to very innocently, seemingly, saying, my pain. But there's a difference between saying the pain and my pain. To say my pain is to attribute it or to possess it or to identify with it. And that's an activity of the mind. The mind has to do something to call it my pain. Now, normally, we don't see that as a problem. But if the mind is quite sensitive and still, you see that the activity of saying my pain is less easeful than simply experiencing it as the pain. So even that, just teasing that apart, the sense of possessiveness or identification with the experience, is part of what this is pointing towards. So if you can just experience something in and of itself, without that extra activity of me-ing and my-ing and selfing that's part of it, then you will find no self here. Of course, there's a self here in some sense. But when you're just purely present for the sound in some direct way, you realize it doesn't make any sense to find a self in the hearing. Just hearing is happening. And the source of the sound over there, there's no self there either. And there's no self here hearing it, and no self there in the origin of the sound, and also there's no self in between. There, the Buddha says, is the end of suffering. If we don't identify, we don't make things into self, don't see things through the lens of self and me, myself, and mine, there's some kind of freedom or ease or happiness that can be born from that. And that's so contrary to how most of our minds work, where it seems so easy and natural and so obvious and so necessary to have me, myself, and mine. This is mine, this is who I am. And there'll be all kinds of ways. So In meditation, it's possible to begin resting the activity of the mind called that makes me, myself, and mine, and have it at rest, and have the sound just be a sound, have a sensation just be a sensation, have a thought just arise and be a thought without anything more added to it. And it can be quite frightening for people sometimes to have this kind of very basic raw perception, because it's frightening not to have a sense of self, or not to have some self to orient ourselves with, to let go of that. All the usual ways we have of thinking about ourselves or understanding who we are kind of are relaxed and rest, come to rest. And that can be disconcerting. But Bahiyo was someone who was a spiritual practitioner for a long time. He was a teacher in some tradition. So we take him to be someone who was quite prepared. Maybe he had already done a lot of work. He had a mind that was quite concentrated. He kind of purified himself, worked through a lot of his things. And so he already came to the Buddha somewhat clear-minded, ready to receive some kind of choice teaching. So the Buddha said this thing to him. And that was enough for him to let go. And there and then, through hearing this brief explanation of the Dharma, the mind of Bahiya, of the bark cloth, right then and there, was released from the clingings, released from all clinging, released from all suffering. He was liberated. And having exhorted Bahiya with this brief explanation, the Buddha left to continue his alms round. So that's a nice story, right? Someone who feels sense of spiritual urgency, he shows up, he demands, "I want it now." So the Buddha kind of gives it to him now, and there he goes. Very nice. But the story continues. And I guess part of the reason why I'm intrigued by this was a comment that was made here on Friday by someone who said, "I don't understand this kind of teaching, because if we don't find self here or self there or self in between, if we just let perception just be perception, then if the car comes barreling down the road and I'm crossing the road, what's going to get me out of the way if I'm not here? There's no self there or self there, you know. So my first answer was, I did a little demonstration to someone. The woman was way over the other side of the hall, so I couldn't do it. But I took this little stick we have here for ringing the bell, and without anybody expecting it, I think, I just kind of tossed it towards someone, and he kind of grabbed it. And then I asked him, in grabbing that flying striker, was there any self? Did you think about self, and I'm doing the one who's doing it, or I have to do it right or good? And he said, "No, there was no self at that, you know, first moment." So I tried to use that as an example that, you know, you can't take care of yourself. You don't have a sense of self to kind of respond in a healthy way or do what needs to be done in an emergency or something. So I don't know if that was a good answer, but I try to say that. But then I thought, you know, I don't think I'll tell these people the rest of the story. But then I did. Uh-huh. And the rest of the story is that they didn't have cars back then. But the equivalent of being run over by a car is what happened to Bahiya right afterwards. Not long after the Buddha's departure, Bahiya was attacked and killed by a cow with a young calf. So you kind of imagine he's walking down the street. You know, in India they have these cows wandering around, and with horns, and, you know, boom. He got gored and died. So. So much for any. Who wants this teaching now? And then when Buddha came back, he was told what had happened, and he told his monks, "Take Bahiya's body and place it on a litter and carry it away, cremate it, and build him a memorial. He was your companion in the holy life who has died. So the Buddha recognized him as being someone who's fully enlightened and gave him a proper burial, cremation. And so what's going on here? Now, we could take this story as being just accurate reporting. You know, they checked their sources before they published it. And just a coincidence. You know, this is unusual things, coincidences happen. Just that he got this teaching and it just happened to be that he died right afterwards. I mean, it could happen to any one of us, right? But I like to think of it a little bit as kind of a mythic story or kind of a teaching story. That somehow this was partly invented, perhaps. The story of the god coming to Bahia and traveling so far, so fast, and all this. So is there more going on, more ways to understand this? And one way, the most obvious way, maybe, is that this little story is pointing to we never know when we're going to die. And we never know, so since we never know, we better get serious. If you want to be serious about a spiritual life, don't put it off until next year. I think I can do it then. I just need a little bit more in my bank account and to pay off for that big car that I got. And then I will go and do my wonderful, retreat or whatever it's going to be. But people are often delaying, putting off doing spiritual life or putting off something which is really important for them. And the sense of not knowing when we're going to die, the sense of the urgency of that, can put a certain kind of fire under us. So let's get serious here. Let's get involved and do what's important. And here, Bahia had that kind of urgency. And it turned out he had good reason to be urgent. Maybe it was his faith that it was his time to die. And maybe he sensed it or knew it. And anyway, it was really good that he got the teachings when he did, because if he hadn't interrupted the Buddha in his alms round, then he might have been killed by the bull anyway, and then died without getting that final teaching in his awakening. So that's one way of interpreting the story. Someone wrote the story of that kind of attempt to kind of say, get serious. You never know. Another way of interpreting the story is that there's a time and a place for certain teachings, and time and place for those teachings are not appropriate. And there's a time and a place for certain kinds of spiritual experiences, meditation experiences, and a time and place where those are not appropriate. And in fact, the kind of experience that what the Buddha was pointing to for Bahia was a very deep teaching that's maybe best not actualized or lived or realized walking down the street. Maybe it's best to do it in an environment, a situation, where it's okay to let go at that deep level. And so my experience of being on long retreats is that the part of the value or the beauty and the opportunity in retreats is that it's set up to be a very safe environment where there's so little that's asked of you, so little that you have to figure out and do, that it's possible to let go of a lot of the things we normally do with our minds. So to experience a very, very deep peace or stillness or letting go. And the clinging, what we hold on to in our psyche, is very subtle, very deep. It's very hard to see in a surface awareness, surface consciousness, kind of street consciousness as you're walking around. It's very hard to see the depths of our psyche. In order to see the depths of our psyche, it helps to get really concentrated, really still, really have an opportunity to practice in some really deep way. And when you can see very, very deeply, then it gives you, it's one of the ways, optimal ways, of plucking out some of the deepest sources of clinging in our hearts. And then we can come back and reintegrate into life again. So when I came back from Burma, I did an 8-month retreat, and the 8 months of silence, intensive retreats, just practicing day and pretty much most of the night. I slept about 4.5 hours a night, and just practice, practice, practice all the time. Stop for meals. And it was a wonderful experience. And part of the way that we practiced was that we were supposed to be mindful not just when we're sitting in meditation, but we're supposed to be very carefully mindful in all our daily activities, which were very minimal. Like I had brushed my teeth, and I would walk to the dining room and go to the bathroom occasionally. I had to wash my own clothes. And the way I did that was, there was one day a week where we didn't have interviews with the teacher. On that day, we weren't accountable for how much we sat. Otherwise, he wanted us to know how many hours we'd done our meditation every day. And you had the sense of, you know, he'd raise his... He was a very tough kind of guy. And you wanted to have a high number for him. And, you know, I meditated for 16, 17 hours this last 24 hours. And if you said you meditated 13 hours, you know, the eyebrow would go up and you wouldn't feel so good. So I was kind of a tough guy. But one day a week, we didn't have interviews. So that's the day I would wash my laundry. And the way I did my laundry was that I had this bucket. And I'd get up from meditation, and I'd fill the bucket. And then I would put, I don't know if you know these electric spoons. It's kind of this, you plug it into the outlet, and it has this, kind of this little coil. And I would put it in the water, in the bucket. And then I'd go back and meditate for another couple hours. And after a couple hours, the water was hot. And then I would stuff my clothes into the bucket. And then I'd go back and meditate for a couple hours. And then I'd wring it out and hang it up. And that was my laundry. Because that was I was trying to do the least I could. I was trying to kind of get away with doing the least possible amount of activity to stay in the flow of the meditation all the time. So it was great. It was really lovely. It was one of the best, happiest times of my life, believe it or not. But when I came back to San Francisco, I was a little bit confused about contexts. And I remember going into a bank and lifting my hand to open the door of the bank, slowly, slowly, reaching the doorknob, pulling the door open. You know, you don't do that on Market Street. Or you do, I guess, but some people do. But it was not appropriate anymore. I was kind of, after 8 months of that kind of way of practicing really slow and practicing very intensely that way, I developed a habit of it, and I kind of thought that's where I was supposed to be. I kind of had confused a certain mode of practice in a certain context with the right way of being in the, you know, the particular, this is the way you're supposed to be in the world as you go about your life. And so I was trying to replicate that retreat way in daily life. And it took me a little while to realize that that wasn't really what you're supposed to do. There was a way of practicing on retreat and a way of practicing outside. And they look very different from each other. So one way of interpreting the story is that Bahia got the teachings that were very deep and very profound, but are meant for a different context. And that he actualized the teachings, but it was he did it in a way that he was not prepared or ready for living in the life immediately right afterwards. He wasn't as present in a certain kind of way to take care of, to watch, get out of the way of the ox, the bull, the cow. So that's just my interpretation, right? So we have to know certain contexts, certain things are, certain spiritual experiences or depths are valuable, but in other contexts, they're not. So that's, what are your thoughts about that? What are your interpretations with the story? Now, of course, if you just let the scene be in the scene, then you just let the story be in the story and don't do anything with the story. But anyway, I'm asking you to do something with the story. How do you interpret the story? Yes? So that's another interpretation, is that in that he was fully enlightened at that point, his work had been done. One of the descriptions of an arhat is someone who's done what had to be done. So he done what had to be done, so there's no reason anymore perhaps to live. And so it was fine to die. That's one way.
Perhaps when a Buddha refuses requests, he has a reason.
Perhaps a Buddha, when he refuses requests, has a reason. Maybe the Buddha hadn't... Yes?
During the holidays,
Well, it does point a little bit to the idea that the basic substance of enlightenment is right here for us, but it's often clouded or covered over by our clingings, our entanglements, our fears, and our greed. And so when we can simplify ourselves enough to empty ourselves or free ourselves from the greed, hate, and delusion, the basic stuff of enlightenment is here already for us. Yes?
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Right, so it was symbolic, and he didn't really die, but what happened was symbolic presentation of that his ego died in that experience. In that sense, may all of us be struck by a bull, by a cow. Yes, please, you.
It strikes me that all of us in this room are walking 700 miles, we're not doing something else. So we've left our daily life this morning. But the story is pointing to you that's not enough.
So simply walking to the doors of a practice hall is not enough. You have to step inside and actually do the practice or present yourself. I kind of I'm touched by the fact that he threw himself down on the feet of the Buddha. that level of sincerity, I see it, kind of humility. Someone who was a teacher before saying, please, I'm open to you, what you have to teach me. Yes?
Someone the other day reminded me of the expression, nothing special, referring to practice. And so he's enlightened, so that's nothing special.
So nothing special.
He still can be called by a cow.
Mm. So nothing special. So being enlightened doesn't save us from human conditions. So even being enlightened, you're still, human conditions will come along and you still might get sick and get old and die. Yes, Steve?
Just at times have really changed in those days, really sincere, and we do it basically ask to show sincerity, ask him 3 times, and then you don't want to be bullied on the disciple, or at least show sincerity because you dropped off his arm, and then on now you show your sincerity when you have to hire him, and you sit for a week for 10 days.
Yeah. there's a there's a tradition in Buddhism that a teacher is not supposed to give a Dharma talk unless he or she's been asked 3 times. And in the Zen tradition, that's ritualized. It's probably most people don't realize it, but there's sometimes in the Zen center, before the person's going to give the talk, there's a little bowing that happens up far away in a distant hallway, and it's supposed to symbolize this sort of, this bowing to 3 times, asking 3 times, requesting 3 times that the person come down and teach. Yes? Is a sense of urgency for enlightenment a form of grasping, and is it therefore a pitfall? It can be, but it doesn't have to be. I think a person can have a great zeal, great passion, great sense of urgency for freeing oneself from all grasping. And it might be some grasping as part of it, but that grasping gets us on the path. And then as we negotiate a path, at some point that grasping has to be let go of also. So one of the teachings is that you don't want to necessarily let go of every attachment that you can see when it first appears. Some graspings and clinging are actually helpful to keep you on the path and engaged. And you can let go of it later if it helps you let go of other ones first. So even if it entails grasping, it's not necessarily so bad. Boy, I think... You'll have to... I had a sore throat all day yesterday, and I woke up this morning just fine. But now there's a stickle. So someone else talk a little bit. Someone else wants to answer that question about urgency? So in the self-talk, let there be just self-talk. Don't complicate it with judgments. So you're saying that in in there being a particular practice or practice experience which is appropriate in one context and not another context, that sets up a dichotomy that has attention as part of it? I'd love to hear it, what it is.
I had an experience with Ajahn Sundra once where I was standing outside the Dharma Hall. I had a Coke in my hand, and I said, somehow we got into this conversation, and I was asking, Dharma questions, and suddenly she just went, wait, we're taught to teach, to only teach when we're in certain situations. And I thought, my immediate reaction was, well, we're here, we're now, and this is like important. But it was really interesting to me because the intention behind her stopping it, and we ended up going and I put down my Coke and we sat down, and is that I had much more respect and attention on her answer. And so rather than it becoming across as kind of a quick answer to something that had come up, it became much more of a strong teaching. And so I interpreted kind of it along those lines more, not so much that the teachings aren't appropriate in any piece of our life, but in terms of really paying attention and fully grasping. I mean, obviously he fully grasped it if he became enlightened, but the respect for the teachings and the teacher in that vicinity. So maybe, I don't know, maybe that helps a little bit.
Yeah. There's a rule for monastics that they're not supposed to teach the Dharma to someone who doesn't show a certain modicum of respect for the teaching. And so if you're hanging out on street corners drinking a Coke and chatting, and it's not so obvious that the respect is there.
So maybe interrupting him on his alms round and not paying full attention was also kind of a sign of just not fully.
Maybe.
And then after the third time, I guess the Buddha decided, well, he is.
So this particular story is in a collection called the Udana. And the Udana is translated as the inspired utterances of the Buddha. And the Buddha kind of sometimes apparently spontaneously uttered verses, inspired verses, just on the spot, just made them up, and they're recorded here. It's considered kind of a minor text in the tradition. And what's unusual about this Udana is that it's kind of like an afterthought, like an appendix to the suttas, almost seemingly, this minor text, this stuff. But it contains some of the more mystical aspects of the Pali Canon. And in the kind of more mainstream text, Discourses of the Buddha, they don't have the same kind of mystical flavor as this one has. And so some people have said, well, maybe this is not really teachings of the Buddha. Maybe they, it seems kind of odd that this particular text has such a strange, different character than all the more important discourses. And that's for, I don't know how to decide that. But this story then ends with a Buddha giving one of these inspired verses. Where water, earth, fire and wind have no footing. There the stars do not shine, the sun is not visible, the moon does not appear, darkness is not found. When a sage, a Brahmin, through sagacity, has known this for himself or herself, then from form and formless, from bliss and pain, he or she is freed. Where water, earth, fire, and wind have no footing. So that's kind of like a, what is that? What does that mean? Where water, earth, fire, wind have no footing. It's often understood to be a synonym of Nibbana. And kind of, I'll end with the last thing in response to Nancy's attempt to ask a question. For a couple of years, I studied in Hawaii with a Zen teacher named Robert Aitken. And he comes from a little more of the Rinzai school kind of flavor of Zen. And with the idea that there's some, you know, breakthrough experience that you could have. And you're pushing and you're kind of working hard, concentrating, working on a koan with a koan in order to kind of have some enlightenment type of experience. And there was a woman there studying with him who had come from the San Francisco Zen Center, practicing there for many years. And there, they kind of almost don't believe in that kind of experience. There, the practice is, you know, everyday life is practice, just this moment is practice. How you meet the next moment is the realization of practice. And just practice kind of an ordinary way and slowly over the years. And you're not trying to go for some big experience. And sometimes people, they'll even poo-poo big experiences, like they don't really count. Or sometimes you get a sense in Soto Zen that big experience is not really real. There is not, it's kind of not really that important or real, or they're overly overemphasized. Or so this woman had come and was studying there, and she started going out with this guy who was a student of Robert Aitken, and he was the guy was into this, you know, Rinzai kind of approach. So they'd have these great arguments, where she would say that, you know, he would say, you know, I'm going for enlightenment, and she'd say, well, there is no enlightenment experience. It's all about how you practice in the moment. And if you have some posit some great enlightenment experience, then you're making some kind of dualistic view of reality, of, you know, some place you're supposed to be as opposed to where you are, and it's just about being where you are and waking up there. And so the arguments go back and forth. And when I heard those discussions they had, I felt that somehow they'd both views had to be accommodated. Both views had some truth to them. And there are dramatic breakthrough experiences that some people have. And if everyday practice is just being present for everything that arises as it is, then that has to, for some people, include at times breakthrough experiences. And if you have some experience like that and they say, oh, that doesn't count. Everything else is practice. Everything is included as part of practice, but not that. which is kind of a sense of gotcha sometimes. That itself kind of separates, it creates a tension that's unnecessary. Is there some kind of holistic view that can hold it all as being ordinary, including the extraordinary things that can happen, where water, fire, wind, and earth have no footing? Is that relevant to what you asked at all, Nancy? Maybe. So anyway, I hope that this was useful for you, this talk. And if it wasn't, please just forget it. Leave it here. And now if you do hear this particular paragraph or this little teaching at some retreat, you'll know the context of it. You can either proliferate your thoughts about it when you hear it again, or you can just leave it simple and let it, in the hearing, just the heard. So thank you very much.